Good morning. You're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis, a weekly news and commentary hour with me, your host, Taylor Weech. Today, I have a great three-way interview with folks putting on this event on Wednesday, this Wednesday, May 8th, Hanford, our nuclear neighbor. Columbia Riverkeeper, Spokane Riverkeeper, Sierra Club, and Gonzaga University will host an evening discussion about our nuclear neighbor, Hanford, connecting its historic downstream impacts to the Columbia River and downwind to Spokane. The event will take place at Gonzaga University School of Law, Barbieri Moot Courtroom at 6 p.m. on May 8th. And that part of the campus is where it intersects with Cincinnati. So I'm going to bring Teresa Labriola and Leslie March on the air right now. They are both part of coordinating this event. Teresa and Leslie, can you hear me? You're on the air.
Yes, we can.
Great.
Hi, Taylor.
Yeah, thanks for joining me this morning. Do you each just want to briefly introduce yourselves and talk about how you got involved doing this type of work and what people can expect on Wednesday?
Sure. I can start with that, if that's okay, Leslie.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. So my name is Teresa, and I work with the Columbia Riverkeeper as their Hanford coordinator. And I got involved working on Hanford only recently when I moved to the Pacific Northwest. And I have a long background in advocacy. For years, I was a litigating attorney, and I sued some of the most egregious polluters of our air and water. And I still have a passion for clean water. And when I moved to the Mid-Columbia Gorge by Hood River, I contacted Columbia Riverkeeper because their work to protect and restore the Columbia matches my sort of lifelong commitment, really. And it worked out that I was able to work with them as their Hanford coordinator. So basically keeping an eye on what's going on at Hanford, how it potentially currently impacting the Columbia, and how we can take the best steps possible to prevent further pollution of the Columbia River. There are, you know, hundreds of decisions made at Hanford regarding cleanup every year. And each one of those has a different potential impact on the Columbia River and on the people who use it, our fishermen, our kite boarders, boaters, you know, who like to birdwatch. So the event on Wednesday, which I hope will have a great turnout, the Columbia River has long had been impacted by Hanford, specifically through direct discharges of polluted water into the Columbia River. So we've been working with groups and putting on events for a long time to educate the public about Hanford. And it's really a natural connection for Columbia Riverkeeper to connect with Spokane Riverkeeper. We're both part of a larger organization called the Waterkeeper Alliance. There are groups around the world that focus on their watershed and protecting and restoring their rivers. And so this one huge, 500-plus square-mile site polluted the Columbia River directly with water discharges in Spokane through air discharges. And so it's a nice time to work together on opposite, really, ends of Washington to come together and talk about how this one site has such an impact on our entire state and area.
Mm-hmm. I feel like Hanford sometimes is kind of the elephant in the room that people forget to address when they talk about environmental issues around here. And it's the biggest, am I right in saying that it's the largest nuclear waste site in the nation?
In the nation, in the Western Hemisphere, the majority of our high-level nuclear waste is there. So it has always been a huge impact environmentally on the community in the area, and it will continue to have an enormous impact for hundreds of years to come.
Wow. So then, Leslie, you are, working on the Sierra Club Nuclear Free Campaign?
Yes, actually, I'm one of the founding members of the campaign, and I have a personal connection to Hanford, which always kind of stuns people in that my great-grandfather founded the town that was originally there before the Manhattan Project decided that they would use eminent domain and take over people's land and their orchards. So my great-grandfather's last name was Haynes, but his father-in-law's last name was Hanford, and the railroad said they already had a stop called Haynes and it would be too confusing, so they named the town Hanford. And when I was a child, I heard from my grandfather and my great uncle many stories of their boyhood days on the Columbia. And my whole family has always been kind of attached to the Columbia. Although, even though I'm a Seattle native, I've lived in other countries and also, you know, all over the United States. But I always seem to come back here, and the Columbia River is really important to my family. And I've always been interested in Hanford and have kind of dabbled in Hanford issues. And I moved back to the Northwest from actually living in another polluted area, a whole state that's polluted, unfortunately, which is Louisiana. And I moved back here and I kind of had to sort of focus on what was I going, because I've always been very active in the community, that what did I want to work on at this point? And Fukushima came, and it really gave me a reality check about the fact that there is one nuclear plant left in the Northwest, nuclear power plant, and it is at Hanford, which kind of presents us with a double jeopardy, and that's kind of what I'm going to talk about, the fact that we are trying to clean up waste that was created for, you know, with the Cold War reactors at Hanford. And at the same time, we are generating similar waste on another section of the same geographic area, the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. So that's pretty much what I'm going to talk about, is kind of the history of the plant. And I amazingly, not a very nice coincidence, but the Columbia Generating Station is a Mark II boiling water reactor, which was designed by General Electric, and the power plants that blew up at Fukushima Daiichi were Mark I's, but there also was a Mark II plant there that partially blew up. The fuel pool is still sitting six stories up, which is the same design as Columbia Generating Station.
Well, that's not very reassuring then. So you said it's the one active plant in the U.S. now?
No, not in the U.S. No, we have 104
In the state. Sorry, excuse me.
Yeah. Well, actually, in the Northwest, because there are no nuclear power plants in Oregon other than small research plants. And there, you know, there is a research plant in Seattle at the University of Washington. But this is Columbia Generating Station, which is located on the Columbia River, on the Hanford Reservation near the Tri-Cities, is the only active power plant in the Northwest.
So,
and it only provides about 3.9% of our region's power needs, but it presents a much larger risk.
And what is, so I know from time to time nuclear gets brought up politically when folks are talking about, you know, moving beyond fossil fuels, as we're obviously going to have to do someday. And it kind of is like a mumbled afterthought after wind and solar and these more friendly sounding options. What do you both think the political climate is right now regarding nuclear? And, you know, is it moving toward expansion in the U.S., or is there a strong enough movement to block that now?
Well, this is Leslie. I'll start the response to that. There is kind of a twofold movement happening. On one side, there are the proponents of the nuclear industry that are in Congress trying to get 100% loan guarantees passed through Congress, and they've actually succeeded in doing that to build new plants. Then, these proponents also claim that nuclear energy will be our saving grace from climate change. They claim that, you know, it's green energy. But that's not the argument, I guess, the other side that I'm with, and that it's not carbon-free energy, because there is a whole fuel chain that you have to follow that starts out with the uranium mining, the processing, the, you know, making the fuel. Making the fuel is kind of is a good point. The Columbia Generating Station actually is owned by Energy Northwest, and Energy Northwest is a group of 27 utilities that does not include Spokane. Spokane is not part of that consortium. But these PUDs all own part of this power station. They were celebrating last year because they were able to get in on a cheap fuel deal where a plant in Paducah, Kentucky that makes the fuel for the fuel rods that go into the reactor had, you know, they made a deal with them. Well, I found out about this nuclear fuel purchase and kind of followed the trail back, and we found out that this particular plant, it's called USEC, it's in Paducah, Kentucky, requires 9 coal plants operating full-time to produce the amount of fuel that Columbia Generating Station was purchasing. So that's kind of a backwards door that, okay, we can say, well, nuclear power, when it's actually being generated, does not have very large greenhouse gas emissions. But to produce the fuel to allow them to operate is really dirty. So, and that's just part of it. So the opposition is very concerned that the industry has always been really strong in the United States, and they've really downplayed the risks. And we really haven't had a contaminating accident in the United States at Three Mile Island. But yet, we actually have 32 nuclear power plants operating in the United States that are the same models and have the same containment issues or design issues as the ones in Fukushima. And there are a lot of other factors that have to do with nuclear safety, like in our mid-Columbia area, we have to be concerned about earthquake dangers. Geologists from the University of Washington and Washington State have actually issued some reports in the last couple of years that show that there are extensive faults in the Hanford area that were not, you know, they didn't know about in the 70s when they originally designed the plant. So that's an issue.
Wow. So hopefully... go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just going to say, why is earthquake a danger? Well, because if there's damage to the building, if there's damage to infrastructure, if they can't keep power to the fuel rods, then that's what causes the radioactive explosions that happened at Fukushima.
So I'm assuming this is why you're going for a nuclear-free campaign, to not wait for something like that to happen to garner a public response to these risks.
Exactly.
All right. Well,
we don't want to see any communities in the United States become sacrifice communities.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to put it. So I'm going to bring on Tim Connor right now, who's the communications director at Center for Justice, a longtime advocate and activist around this issue and part of the Hanford Concerns Council. Mm-hmm. I think I said that right.
You did.
And he's going to talk a little bit about the history of the site and how we got to some of the issues we have today.
Yeah, that's a mouthful. Well, you know, the first thing to say about Hanford is that it traces its origins to the Manhattan Project. It was part of a very hasty search to find at least a couple places in the United States where the government could take big tracts of land to synthesize plutonium and make uranium for atomic weapons. This was back during the so-called Manhattan Project. And Oak Ridge, Tennessee wound up being the site where we produced the uranium for example, the Fat Man bomb that was dropped in Hiroshima. Hanford became the source of the plutonium that was dropped on Nagasaki. And what was remarkable from a technical standpoint is that the plutonium at Hanford was created in nuclear reactors along the Columbia and extracted in long battleship-sized buildings. And that was built up, just in a period of months from laboratory scale, almost desktop scale processes. And when it was replicated on an enormous scale, what you have was tremendous amounts of nuclear waste and hazardous chemicals being created. During the wartime haste of the Second World War and the Second World War Manhattan Project and the Cold War, not a lot of attention was given to how these wastes would be stored. So a lot of them were dumped on the ground. A lot of them were put in approximately 150 single-wall tanks, virtually all of which are assumed to be leaking now. And so they do pose long-term threats to the Hanford site and to the Columbia River. We have done a lot of work over the years in shutting down plutonium production at Hanford. That's kind of where I came in the 1980s. I helped with a campaign not only to shut down the last plutonium-producing reactor, known as the N reactor, but also the last and the world's largest plutonium extraction plant, the Purex plant. So both those plants are shut down. And one of the good things about that is we don't have as immediate a threat right on the Columbia River from having an active antiquated reactor fissioning away. I mean, a lot of what brought N reactor's demise were its similarities to Chernobyl. That's no longer there. So with great satisfaction that on a recent trip, I actually saw them taking a backhoe to removing the N reactor. But we have a legacy of long-lived waste at Hanford that have to be dealt with. We're spending billions of dollars a year to try to get that waste stable and ultimately in a form where it won't pose a long-term threat to the environment. But it's been a Herculean effort. So that's Hanford's history in a nutshell.
And what's the, I guess any of you can jump in and respond to this, but what is the scale of this waste? And though this might seem like an obvious question, what are the health concerns and the specific environmental damage that's done by this type of waste on that type of scale?
Well, there's obvious concern about the long-term health of the Columbia River. Fortunately, and I use that word with quotation marks around it, most of the nastiest waste and the nastiest volumes of the waste are on a plateau 8 miles from the Columbia River. So it's not as though we have a time bomb that can go off and an hour later we're getting high levels of radioactive contamination in the Columbia River from this waste. That, in all honesty, that just won't happen. The problem is there has been such a... the problem is you've got a lot of this stuff between the surface and the Hanford water table. And when it reaches the water table, there is a pathway to the Columbia River. So in order to protect the river, we've got to make sure that that waste is stable so that it doesn't, you have long live waste like plutonium. You don't want that winding up in the Columbia River. Some of the work that I did with scientists when I was at the Hanford Education Action League is look at the springs along the Columbia River where we could actually see radioactive tritium, which is a radioactive form of hydrogen that is produced as a waste in the plutonium recovery process. That was making itself down through old channels beneath Hanford and emerging. We actually have video photography of it popping up, this wastewater popping up in springs along the Columbia, right in an area where, you know, you've got salmon nests, for example. So we established that the pathway was there. Fortunately, again, in quotation marks, waste like plutonium doesn't move nearly as rapidly through the environment as waste like tritium and the nitrates from the chemical pollution. So there is time, but you have to actually spend the money to do the stabilization. And frankly, we're making up for, again, these really haphazard and short-sighted waste practices that were put in place during the Manhattan Project and in the Cold War during the 50s.
Yeah, if I could jump in, this is Teresa. There are the direct discharges that used to take place where water, cooling water, was discharged directly into the Columbia or directly into trenches along the Columbia. left it with a definitely historic scar. And you were talking about what are some of the environmental concerns now. You know, our concerns are that the Hanford Reach is one of the longest free flowing stretch of the Columbia River, south of Canada, basically. It's the prime spawning ground for Chinook salmon, and contaminants like and radioactive waste like uranium, strontium can potentially affect the reproductive success of salmon. And so although the contamination is not pouring into the Columbia anymore, there still is the threat. There still is, you know, right now, 40, hundreds of millions of gallons of contaminated groundwater that is moving towards the Columbia. And although the Department of Energy is putting in place systems to pull out the groundwater, treat it before the contaminants can reach the Columbia River, those systems are always subject to budget and to technological failure, and they're not all in place. And so there is a long way to go until the Columbia is protected from Hanford.
Great. And then as far as effects, so the Tri-Cities were basically built, more or less expanded to the size they are now because of Hanford. Is that safe to say? That's
absolutely, yeah.
And what's the effect on those cities and that region? And then also the effect on Spokane being downwind from all of this prior pollution?
Well, it helps to look at the past. I mean, the thing about the past is it's scary. I mean, keep in mind that during the 50s, especially, we had 8 single pass reactors on the edge of the Columbia. So, for example, my grandfather, who died of throat cancer, wasn't a smoker, was drinking water from the Pasco intake, which regularly and without notification to people in Pasco was resulting in a much higher radiation dose from drinking water than would be allowed today. This is because water was being circulated through these single pass. When I say single pass, there was just a single loop. There was no effort to capture the cooling water and recycle it in those years, because the reactor technology was so rudimentary. So you had, and fuel rods would break, so this stuff would be flushing right into the Columbia River, headed downstream. It's literally true that people that were collecting clamming on the coast would eat the clams and then try to enter a nuclear facility and set off radiation alarms because of the radioactive zinc 65 that was accumulating in their body from Hanford, because, you know, the way this stuff bioaccumulates in the environment. So we've seen these old pathways. The other thing that people in Spokane will remember, because the Hanford downwinder trial has been in Spokane, is that Spokane and every community in between Hanford and Spokane was exposed quite considerably to radioactive iodine during the 40s and 50s from the Hanford reprocessing plants, Purex and its forerunners, because when you harvest plutonium, you break open highly radioactive fuel. I mean, the plutonium is a very small percentage of what's in there. The rest is, you know, basically waste, and includes fission products like iodine-131, which is treated by the body chemically the same way stable iodine is. Your thyroid takes it in, and you get a very large dose to the thyroid as a result, particularly if you're a kid and particularly if you're drinking milk. And that did happen not just in Spokane, but throughout the Columbia Basin. So it was. So we have these pathways. I mean, I think Teresa was mentioning the long-term concerns with an active reactor at Hanford. So as long as we have active reactors at Hanford, Spokane is going to be downwind, and there are legitimate concerns for that. And if there were ever a disastrous fire, say in the Hanford waste grounds, certainly Spokane would be downwind from that. But those would be the main concerns.
And this is Leslie. And kind of to tie Columbia Generating Station into this, their annual pollution reports show that their emissions are increasing. And the only data we have actually from the plant is for 2010, but there was a steady increase in radioactive emissions from the plant. And also, they were cited last year by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission because their calibration equipment was not operating properly. And it turns out that between 2001 and 2011, if there was a radioactive accident or incident, they wouldn't have been able to detect it because their calibration equipment was incorrect. So that's kind of scary.
Yeah, that's so we don't know
what we may have been exposed to. But I have the same kind of stories from my family. I mean, my grandmother died of leukemia, and she, you know, lived in Hood River. And I have a cousin who lived in Prosser who one of her children had a heart defect that when I described it to a fellow nuclear activist just kind of looked at me and said, oh, well, that's Chernobyl heart. And I'm like, oh, my God, I didn't think that something like that was happening, you know, right next to Hanford or in the communities that were within the 50 miles. And one of the things that at least we're concerned about for Columbia Generating Station is the 50-mile radius from the plant may seem like, because, you know, the reservation itself is so large, not being that effective, but it actually includes a lot of the agricultural producing areas of Washington. And Washington State last year took like $9 billion out of that area in food exports. So it's an economic engine. It's not just, you know, I mean, that mid-Columbia area, not just the bedroom communities for Hanford.
Definitely. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on Thin Air Community Radio, KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, and I'm live on the air with Teresa Labriola from Columbia Riverkeeper, Tim Connor from Center for Justice and Hanford Concerns Council, and Leslie March from Sierra Club Nuclear Free Campaign. They're here promoting an upcoming event this Wednesday, May 8th, from 6 to 8 p.m., which I believe is free. Called Hanford, Our Nuclear Neighbor, which is a talk that you'll all be giving. Will you all be on that panel?
Yeah. Okay.
6 to 8 p.m. at the Gonzaga University School of Law, the Barbieri Moot Courtroom, which is on Cincinnati, where Cincinnati intersects with the campus. So what can folks expect going to that free talk, and what is the... I mean, obviously, we've listed a lot of concerns. What space is there for participation from the public in all of this work? You all came in from various concerns, but what can people do if they're concerned about this when they learn more?
Well, I think that what's interesting about Wednesday is every time I talk about Hanford, I meet new people who are just learning about it. And I confess, I'm an East Coaster. And I only moved to Oregon about a year ago. And I knew, I should have known more about Hanford, put it that way, than I did, being that it's in our, not only in the Northwest, but it's part of our history of the United States. And every time I give a talk, even in the Northwest, I always meet people who know, who don't know a lot about Hanford. And are surprised by some of the history, some of the statistics, some of what's going on. And so it's always really good to give a history of the site and put it back into beginner's language, so to speak. It's always good for us all to remember where it comes from and exactly what it is. And it's, you know, as Tim said, it's the legacy of the Cold War. So we'll definitely, you know, give that overview. And then... be able to talk about its impact on the Columbia River and potential effects downwind to Spokane, and mostly historical effects. But when I talk, I always encourage people to get involved, and I give ways for people to get involved in something that's currently going on. And so on Wednesday, I'll probably talk a bit about something that's not that fun, but that's really important, and that's the budget at Hanford. So we all, many of us have heard that Hanford is, about $2 billion a year of our goes to Hanford for Hanford's cleanup. And this year, there's they're developing the budget for next year, and one major concern that we have is what seems like a lack of funding for groundwater treatment. Although, as groundwater treatment, I was telling you before that there's 80 square miles of contaminated groundwater that the Department of Energy has put these pump and treat facilities, they're called. So they pump water out of the pump groundwater out of the ground. They treat it to remove some of the contaminants and nuclear contaminants, and they put it back in. So that as this groundwater progresses towards the Columbia, it's not as contaminated as it would be. Well, there are many more facilities to be installed, and there's also these are facilities that will require many, many years of they'll have to run for many, many years, basically. And so there should be an increase in funding for a program like this in order to, as you know, we progress and get more facilities in, that means there'll be more money to maintain them, and we'll have more money for drilling new wells, putting in new pump and treat facilities. But this year there's a dramatic decrease in the proposed funding. And what concerns me about this is it reminds me of a lot of things that I think I see come up at Hanford, where it's out of sight, out of mind. The groundwater is out of sight, and so it's a program, I think, that is susceptible to cuts in funding, and yet it's the last defense for the Columbia River and for those people who use the Columbia River. So we'll talk about things like that. That's a real cutting-edge current. Actually, there's an open public comment period in the next month about that issue. So whenever I talk, there, I not only give a history, but I go, okay, what's going on today? Why is it important? How can you help? And, of course, we'll ask the questions from the public and be happy to talk about things that interest people in the audience. So we hope everyone can join us.
I think it's a real challenge to address Hanford as a legacy. Things nuclear are pretty scary, and Fukushima certainly proved that. And people always have to have a mindful eye if they live near or downwind from a nuclear plant. But I think it's really important to be honest with people about, you know, what has happened at Hanford. I mean, when I came, there was a very active community in Spokane in the 80s about Hanford, and for obvious reasons. We had an active, uncontained, large reactor that resembled Chernobyl. We had the world's largest fuels reprocessing plant. When I went to work for the Hanford Education Action League in the 1980s, it was literally illegal under Washington state law for a state regulator for the Department of Ecology to even go on the Hanford site without the permission of the federal government. Because the law was then that having the states regulate these bomb plants was a threat to national security. So we did a lot of work. We got laws changed. We shut down plants. We got the Hanford cleanup agreement done. And what we're left with is this long-term environmental threat, which frankly would pose a much greater threat had the Hanford site not... I mean, there used to be three town sites on the Hanford site. I mean, some of the first produce that showed up in markets in Seattle was harvested from farms at Hanford. You can still see the furrows in the ground if you go out and look around White Bluffs and Hanford. A lot of the reasons that we're not talking about imminent threats to public health is because the public was evicted from the Hanford site. So that today, I mean, my major concern about human health today is those workers that we're sending out to those tank farms. That are having to deal in close proximity with the waste that we're trying to stabilize. And we've got to make sure that the people like us who mobilize to get the Hanford cleanup done don't fall asleep in terms of protecting those people who are really risking. They're the ones that are going to be taking the immediate radiation dose and the hazardous chemical doses if things go wrong. So it really tests I'm not trying to downplay the threats to the Columbia River. That's not my job. But I'm really concerned that those of us who, you know, mobilize and got some work done at Hanford don't forget that the hazards are still there and that day by day we're asking people to go out there and absorb the brunt of those risks in order to get the cleanup done. And if God forbid, we're asleep at the switch and putting them in situations where they're going to get hurt or you know, receive fatal doses. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've had in recent years, we've had workers become very injured and disabled just by being exposed to chemical vapors from these tank farms. So it's really important that we have the long-term stewardship, not just environmentally, but ethically, to make sure that this work gets done well. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you know, the state of Washington did take a bullet of risk and contamination from hosting this this secret bomb plant. And the federal government has to be responsible for ameliorating that risk, protecting people, and making sure that the Hanford site, to the extent that it can be, is made available for future generations.
Mm-hmm. And it's really, I mean, it's inextricable. It's not an either or by any means. You know, it's, you have to protect the river and the workers and the people downwind and everyone, you know, because it's all connected. So,
and it's a great technological challenge as well. Just as, you know, basically we built a nuclear reactor in a year, and it's been a lot more difficult to contain it all after the fact. But I'm thinking of what Tim's saying, and it's making me think of the vitrification plant. So there's, just for people who are online who might not know, there's the highest level of nuclear waste is stored underground in tanks. There's 56 million gallons of it. And the plan for the majority of this is to process it in a vitrification plant, which will turn it into, physically put it into a glass log. So it'll be in a more solid state that's not as easily transferred to the environment. But that, Tim, would you probably have a concern that this is a plant that's never been built. It's a one of a kind, and it you know, could be very potentially hazardous to those people who work around it.
Yeah, and it might not work.
And it might not work.
I've been writing about this on the center's website. You know, the experience of Walt Thomasitis and other scientists that have been working this. This is, for those who don't know, this is also the most expensive ongoing public works project in the United States at this time, is this grand attempt to build a one-of-a-kind vitrification plant that will take this very toxic radioactive tank waste and convert it into glass logs that will ultimately be stored underground in a people refer to it as a repository. It makes it sound like a bank. It's a geologic cavern where this stuff will be supposedly geologically isolated for countless millennia. But sadly, we've seen the same kind of loose auditing and loose attention to technical development. And so we've got some major questions about whether this plant will even be able to operate safely without experiencing hydrogen explosions and perhaps recriticality events in the tanks and tubes that are necessary to process the waste for this glass process. So it does, I've been writing about that. Also, my longtime friend Tom Carpenter at Hanford Challenge has been actively involved in advocating for Thomasitis and other whistleblowers at the site. If you go to the Hanford Challenge website, you can read about this as well. And it's just like, it's sad because we're spending so much money there, and the prospect that this may not work and that we'd be stuck not only with a white elephant but with a lot of waste that isn't being successfully treated kind of gives me heartburn.
Mm-hmm. What are those two sites for folks who want to read more of your and Mr. Carpenter's writing?
Well, I don't have, if you Google Hanford Challenge, you'll certainly get it. I'm spacing on the name.
HanfordChallenge.org.
Okay.
Go figure.
Thank you.
This is Leslie, and there is a really great briefing paper that Tom Carpenter did on the Hanford Waste Treatment Plant. And I was going to mention Robert Alvarez, who is a high-level policy analyst with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the federal government, and is now retired and speaking freely, feels that this plant is really has a flawed design. And it kind of reinforces at least the concern that I personally have always had about Hanford, is that there's no accountability. that we have been spending billions and billions of dollars to try to come up with the answer for restoring, you know, for doing something, restoring the land, for protecting us from the waste, all these different issues, and it just seems like it's just a money pit. And that kind of brings up, you know, my concerns about Columbia Generating Station is that we have, we're just continuing to create waste at a site that we are trying to find a solution for how to treat waste. So it doesn't make sense if we don't know how to treat it to continue making it.
Taylor, I was maybe Leslie can elaborate on this a little. I was at a talk with Sierra Club some weeks ago, and I think that she might be able to talk a little more about this, but the other challenge of having this nuclear power plant at this site is, as Tim said, if something were to go wrong at the vitrification plant, you may not be able to get to the nuclear power plant to operate it efficiently, effectively, safely.
Good point.
Or as it is currently being operated, and vice versa. And so the fact that you have the two next to each other definitely creates more of a potential risk.
Yeah, that's kind of why we've coined that phrase, the double jeopardy, because if there's an accident at either plant, I mean, either site, the high-level radioactive waste sites at Hanford, or there's an accident at a Columbia Generating Station, the two being so close in proximity could, you know, cause really severe problems, particularly if, you know, what if there is an accident at the, you know, that has to do with the VIT plant. One of the things that I've read, and I am not a scientist or an expert in this, I'm more of a social scientist, talks about, you know, it's a possibility that this VIT plant doesn't work, that it could have explosions. So if there was an explosion, there was so much radiation that you couldn't safely go on the site, then how could the workers get to Columbia Generating Station and continue to operate it safely, and how could they still be safe? It seems like kind of a extreme example, but the potential is there, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a potential for all types of apocalyptic scenarios here with this kind of perfect storm of factors that, you know, at this point, it sounds like, despite the flaws in this plant to solidify the waste, the other option for the waste appears to be to leave it in liquid form and build better tanks? What are the other options for cleanup?
Well, yeah, I guess we should clarify. It's not in liquid form. I mean, all these tanks have been have had the moisture sucked out of them. So what we've got is something like peanut butter.
Ooh.
That is
sludge.
Yeah, and it's a witch's brew of stuff left over from a lot of different campaigns at Hanford to create a lot of different nasty materials. And it creates, you know, its own unique blend of off gases that these workers can get exposed to and injured by. These tanks also leak from the top, so there is water that can come into these tanks when it rains. Fortunately, Hanford is not Savannah River, where I've also worked, where it rains constantly, but there is that danger. We keep getting surprised, I mean, by what happened. I mean, Fukushima being the latest one. Chernobyl could not have happened. I mean, it's hard to rule out these, really nasty scenarios that could evolve at places like Hanford. The other thing I worry about, just from a sociological and economic standpoint, is Hanford takes in a lot of money. $2 billion a year, and it has created its own interest group. I mean, it's sobering to see that West Side politicians, when they deal with Hanford, are being influenced by the money that's spent there. And there's a tendency to look at Eastern Washington through places and an interest group that harvests the money from these projects. So I'm really concerned about their long-term influence there and introducing even more bad nuclear ideas to Hanford when we We actually do have the opportunity in the long term to make a transition to something that's more sane and economically and environmentally sustainable. But we can't get to that if we're constantly feeding money to interest groups and they're influencing our politics as to what is possible in Hanford. So it's one of my long-term concerns, certainly, as someone who was born in Hanford and, grew up in the area.
So at least...
I think what Tom's talking about also is the small modular reactors, which are kind of, like another little... Well, they're not quite an elephant in the room yet, but they're, the pony in the room that the site has... TRIDEC, which is the local economic development council, has tried to get contracts from Department of Energy to build these small modular reactors at Hanford. And we also have been here in Oregon. We have Oregon State is involved in designing the small modular reactors. In the last go-around, the prize went to Savannah River, which the folks that live there aren't too happy about it. But it's just kind of, it's like we keep trying to find this sort of magic bullet that will be, that somehow harnessing the atom is going to make life better. And instead of, I guess, my personal opinion that, we had this experiment with the atom and we need to stop because of all of what we've, harnessed so far, which is nothing other than causing a lot of problems. And I guess people don't really understand, because radiation is invisible.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something you're just glaringly seeing.
It's not an oil spill.
And also the concept of the long-term effects. I mean, we're talking about way after we're even a blip. I have a husband who's a geologist, and he always keeps reminding me when I get really upset about something that, remember, you're on geologic time.
Mm-hmm. This is a society that's not highly concerned with the long term in a lot of cases, unfortunately. But so it sounds like the thrust of activism on this issue is mainly stop it, stop what's going on now, and clean it at the same time. Stop it and clean it? Is that a good oversimplified?
Well, in our case with the Columbia Generating Station, it's replace it. Replace it with renewables, replace it with energy efficiency and conservation.
And, the interesting part about the word clean it is, for Hanford, clean means taking it away from the river, taking it away from where it's going to be most readily exposed to humans and the environment. But, as Leslie said, it will still be there for many, many years, many, many hundreds of thousands of years to come. So if you solidify your nuclear waste and put it in a repository in a bank, that's what we consider clean, but it's still there. We can't make it go away.
Well, I think, I'm sort of semi-retired. I'm no longer a day-to-day Hanford activist. But to the extent that this cleanup issue surfaces for me, one of the interesting choices that we've really yet to get focused on is, what do we want the Hanford site to be? What is the level of cleanup and restoration? What are we trying to accomplish there? What do we see for it in the future? And there's an active debate about that. It's one of the most sensitive topics between the environmental community and the Tri-City Economic Development community. In a perverse way, the contamination of the Hanford site makes it more amenable to make the argument that it should continue to be a nuclear site and essentially a working national sacrifice area. And if you do that, you will remove the argument for spending the money to finish cleaning up the Hanford site. So there's these kinds of perversities to it. And it's just important, I think, for... You sent people in Spokane and other places in Washington want to get involved in this, is that they exercise their voice for what they want to see happen and not leave that to the economic interests at Hanford, which, as your other guests have mentioned, traditionally, I remember when TRIDEC was the Tri-City Nuclear Industrial Council, and you know, was just absolutely gung-ho for everything nuclear about the site. And that's their DNA. I mean, they want to, there's long been the vision of having Hanford be, you know, one of the crown jewels of the nuclear movement, not just in the United States and the world. If folks have a different vision of that, if we want to see Hanford return to something that, you know, can even do agriculture again and renewables, and people are going to have to speak up and make sure their voices are heard in that, because it's not going to happen by itself.
Mm-hmm. It's really a lasting part of the, you know, the history and the character of the area. Wasn't one of the high school team mascots a mushroom cloud?
Yeah, the Richland Bombers, of course. Yeah.
So that's no longer, is it?
No, I believe they're still the Bombers.
Oh, yes, well, they are. Well, there you go. So, I mean, it's very pervasive, and I think your point about actively offering an alternative is important. I've seen in a lot of causes the powers that be kind of shut down if you're just saying, no, 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 take this out. But if people are offering a plausible alternative, I think that's a much stronger...
It is, and I've just having seen this, it's still very tense between... the environmental community. People in the Tri-Cities basically regard environmentalists as people from Seattle. And they don't like people from the West Side telling them what to do. But they don't like people in Spokane telling them what to do either. There's this sense that somehow they own the place. We should be listening to, among others, Russell Jim and the Yakima Nation. I mean, and the other tribes that have treaty rights at Hanford. I mean, their voices need to be heard and accounted for here as well, and in the past they haven't really been honored the way they should be.
So in these last few minutes that we have, what would each of you like to add about Wednesday's event, or just about Hanford in general, if you had a few closing thoughts you could leave folks with?
I guess I can start. So speaking on behalf of Columbia Riverkeeper, it's great to work with Spokane Riverkeeper and Center for Justice and Sierra Club, because we all do approach Hanford from a different angle. And so you can see, even amongst, there are so many ways to get involved with Hanford and so many places to focus. And although... as Columbia Riverkeeper, we tend to focus on the impact to the Columbia and preventing continued pollution and contamination and long-term, promoting the long-term health of it. All the other issues on site are just as important. And so on Wednesday, I hope that we can give the people of Spokane this balanced look at there's a place for each of us to get involved in Hanford, whether you are a fisherman and you're concerned about its impact on the river, or you're, you have an interest in the cultural history of the area and a long-term vision for what the site should be. We all have an interest in Hanford, and it is easier, I think, for some people and a lot of people to bite off a small portion of it and say, I'm going to work on this, because it needs all of our attention.
Great.
Well, I think, Spokane at one point in the 80s was the straw that stirred the drink in terms of Hanford activism. And it hasn't been in recent years. And I think there are people that have moved to Spokane, even people that have lived here since those years, that can really benefit from finding out what has happened in the last decade and a half, and where things are. You know, further, I just, you know, one of the things I do is open water swimming, and I'll dive in the Columbia from time to time. And I dive in there knowing pretty well what the risks are from the work I did on Hanford groundwater and so forth. But I would like other people to be able to dive in the Columbia with at least a sense that there's nothing being kept from them, that people are doing a competent job in protecting the river. And this is, obviously, there are many more fishermen than swimmers that use the river, but I would like people to go out there and be able to, catch salmon and other fish and feel safe that they can eat them without worrying about irradiating themselves and their family. To me, that peace of mind still has a lot of value. Spokane is part of our, like the Tri-Cities. I mean, you're only, you know, one or two marriages is removed from having relatives in Spokane or that work at Hanford. And, we, you know, people need to know that. We are one big extended family in Eastern Washington. People really need to care about how healthy people are and how healthy our environment is. And I would hope that Wednesday night people will learn enough at least to be able to locate themselves and their concerns in that geography.
Well, I would like to hope that people who come to this talk will be feel like they have received an education on what's going on at Hanford, and that and maybe an awakening of previous interests in Hanford or creating new interests. I think that we are going to offer, as I said, three distinct viewpoints on Hanford, but our commonality is that we're looking to get people to advocate for, you know, more sustainable more sustainable work out at Hanford that, you know, protects the river, protects the air, protects people, protects our economy. One of the things that when I have people say, oh, if they close down the power plant, what will happen to the workers? Well, you know, there's a lot of work to be done out at Hanford for the cleanup. The cleanup could last into geologic time. I think that we're not looking about removing jobs. I think we would actually be promoting new jobs in phasing out the Columbia Generating Station and replacing it with renewables. One of my ideas about renewables is that there is a small solar array that's been, solar farm that's experimental at White Bluffs, and I'd like to see more of that out there at the reservation. I work with the Sierra Club Nuclear Free Campaign, and we are part of a coalition of groups that include Positions for Social Responsibility, the Washington and Oregon chapters, No Nukes Northwest, the Alliance for Democracy, and we would hope that Spokane groups would want to join with us. And, of course, Columbia Riverkeeper is also one of our members. So I'm hoping that people will come out on Wednesday and look forward to meeting them.
Great. And the details one more time on that. Hanford, our nuclear neighbor, panel discussion, interactive discussion at Gonzaga Law School Barbieri Moot Courtroom, 6 p.m. this Wednesday, May 8th. Is Wednesday. Another thing I forgot to mention that's here on the Facebook event, you can find this on Facebook, Columbia Riverkeeper will give away a seat on their Hanford paddle trip, an 18-mile journey along the free-flowing Hanford Reach of the Columbia. So I'll be entering that drawing
cool. When
I'm there on Wednesday. Thank you all for being here on the air with me. Tim Connor from Center for Justice, Teresa Labriola from Columbia Riverkeeper, and Leslie March from Sierra Club Nuclear Free Campaign.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.